With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
From Postcard from the Past and Wardour Studios, this is Podcast from the Past, the Postcard Podcast. This is the podcast where we spend more time than is strictly necessary wondering about pretty little cardboard oblongs and how that white space can be filled with clichés, gossip, news, weather reports, poetry, or a mixture of all of the above, as we attempt to understand the memories, meanings, and stories held by picture postcards. I'm Tom Jackson, and today I'm delighted to say that my guests are comedy writer and novelist Paul B. Bassett Davis, and editor and language obsessive guru David Shariat Madari. David and Paul, hello and welcome.
Hello.
Hello.
Now, David Shariat Madari is a writer and editor at The Guardian, specialising in looking at the twists and turns of the language we use and hear, and the opinions also behind the news. And he recently put to the sword some common misconceptions about language in his excellent new book, Don't Believe a Word, a fact checker on some of the myths we tell ourselves about language and how it works, as well as a spin round the major linguistic theories, and it includes swearing. David comes to us with an LN1 postmark.
That's right, that's Lincoln, where I spent the formative years of my life.
Very good. And David, do you still send postcards?
I'm afraid I don't. The only postcards in my life are the postcards I get from my mum when she goes gallivanting around. But I'm unfortunately a bit lax in returning the compliment, returning the favour of sending postcards myself.
Well, I'll let that hang there. I'm not gonna criticise you for that. Now, Paul B. Davis is a man of many parts. Mainly funny ones. He started out in one-man shows at the Edinburgh Festival Fringe. You'll have heard his comedy on the radio that he either wrote or produced or both, including Do Go On with Graham Garden and Griffiths Jones, the radio sitcom At Home with the Hardys with the much-missed Jeremy Hardy, or his own sitcom Reception. Paul also wrote the screenplay for the feature animation film The Magic Roundabout and his novel in front of me. Big, large tome. Dead Writers in Rehab is a funny, hallucinatory, literary comedy about writers, with unusually a title that absolutely describes it. Dead Writers in Rehab. That's the plot. And Paul comes to us today bearing what postmark?
E9.
Is that where you are these days, or where you were? Or?
That's where I am right now. I don't know what the postmark is where I was born, because I was born in Yorkshire.
Ah.
But my parents moved when I was two. But I soon found their new address, and I was hot on their heels. Now, I'm in Hackney. I'm the oldest hipster in town.
Very good. And, Paul, when did you last send a postcard?
Quite recently. I don't know exactly. I do still send postcards. I tend to send arty pictures, usually my favourite pictures or odd pictures. I kind of have a habit of whenever I go to a gallery or a bookshop, I buy a postcard or two. So I send pictures, some favourites that I've got, but others just odd things. I'd like to see postcards survive, because I think it's a lovely thing to get and a nice thing to do.
So you use them to keep in touch with people?
Yeah, or just send as a... Yes, I guess so. That's probably the short version, yeah.
Well, we'll find out more about the kind of cards you've sent over the years shortly. Before we discover the cards David and Paula brought along, I'll give you a quick card of mine. This is, of course, a postcard from the past card, like I do on Twitter, a past postcard. An old card from which I've selected just a part of the message. So we'll start with this one. This is Dove Cottage, Grasmere, another dead writer. Whose colleague appears in your book? In fact.
Yes, I don't know if Wordsworth was a substance abuser, but Coleridge was certainly.
He hung around with a lot.
He certainly, yes, exactly. It's a bit like what they say about Trump or somebody. You may not be a racist, but every one of your friends is a racist. Yes. Yeah, I mean, every one of Wordsworth's friends seemed to have a heavy laudanum habit.
Yeah, so. Maybe, I think he was supplying, to be honest. But yeah. Anyway.
That's Wordsworth Cottage, isn't it?
Yes.
So
yes.
I remember being there, and they do have a cabinet in the upstairs room which has a file of Black Drop, which is laudanum.
Yep.
So it was definitely part of Wordsworth's life as well.
And the sister, Dorothy, she had suffered from nerves, vast army of twittering spinsters throughout Britain who'd be very upset if you told them they were taking drugs, but used to swig from the little black bottle all the time.
I remember, now I may be completely misremembering this, and it's just come to me, but I remember reading, I think I was reading De Quincey, if I might drop that name, and he wrote about many things, but I think he talked about when he was staying with Wordsworth at Dove Cottage, and what really upset him, he got a new book had arrived, a new book, the pages were still uncut, as books used to be in that rather nice way, and Wordsworth, I hope I got the story the right way around, and Wordsworth was at the breakfast table and took a talk, we were discussing breakfast for our sound checks, he took a butter knife that still had butter on it. And opened the pages of De Quincey's book. And I think this probably sent De Quincey into another of his crazed journeys. But anyway.
Pretty insensitive.
You'd have to have a slug of opium after that.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Anyway, at the breakfast table tales from Dove Cottage.
Lucky he didn't end up with the butter knife in his throat.
Yeah. Of course, I could have got it the wrong way around. Maybe it was Wordsworth. Anyway, it doesn't really matter. So this is a card of Dove Cottage from 1961. It was the centenary of post office savings that year, as the postmark, the stamp points out. And this intrigued me because David's here and we're looking at one thing we talk about is the way language changes. And they're describing their holiday, this person who is just known as the letter G, or possibly J, doesn't give their name. And they say, the journey yesterday, as hot as rocket re-entry, and hot here too. And I thought, that's quite interesting. Rocket re-entry being used as a phrase in 1961. You'd think it would have come.
It might have even been before Sputnik, because wasn't Sputnik just before Sputnik early 60s, or maybe it's late 50s?
We'll have to.
The one with the dog, Leica.
Oh, Leica the dog.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So it would have been in the news,
yeah.
It was the beginning of the space race when it was just rockets and maybe not.
Yeah. And people, but re-entry, not just going up and disappearing. So I thought I was intrigued by that because I've got it right, the date, 61. So 8 years before the Apollo mission that we've been recently sort of commemorating, they were using the phrase rocket re-entry. So notes and queries, isn't it? It's not the most important thing, but it's interesting to me.
Unless he was one of these people plucked from the Nazi V2 program, like Wernher von Braun.
Yeah,
innocent life visiting Wordsworth's cottage.
Well, then there's a more sinister explanation, which is it could be about nuclear weapons and re-entry of warheads.
The rockets gone so
up.
Far up.
But then maybe that's a later development because
I think it might be.
You have something, this is a slightly nerdy thing that I know a little bit about, but you have these multiple independently targeted re-entry vehicles. So they're the warheads that come down off a nuclear rocket.
Right.
And can be independently, but they are re-entry. So maybe that's, because that's the height of the Cold War, isn't it?
Yeah, 61, it's still pretty chilly, I think. Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, more research required. If you could both go away and find out for me, that would be...
I expect you'll have hundreds of outraged listeners writing in.
There's going to be so many.
I'd like hundreds of listeners.
Right, OK. Well, perhaps outrage will stimulate them.
Good. Well, thank you for clearing that up so effectively for me. I'll just do one more because that was quite controversial. This is from 1971, and it's another rural scene. This is of... Also near Keswick, actually, funny enough, Borrowdale. And the reason I was interested in this is quite different. It's a sort of little social moment, really. And it was sent to Manchester from someone called... It looks like it's called She. She, as in the Rider Haggard, She. Perhaps that's... Maybe it's Sue. No, I think it's She. And they're discussing something that happened. They said, on Saturday night, we went for the annual mountaineering club dinner in a hotel in Keswick. We had melon, Cumberland vegetable soup, paupiette of sole with shrimp sauce, turkey with cranberry sauce, and fruit salad, coffee, and after eight mints.
Mm.
So, is your stomach rumbling or do you feel slightly nauseous?
No, I'm drooling.
What was the date? I only had one piece of toast for breakfast.
This was in 1971, 6th of May.
I mean, it reminds me a bit of, you know, the 70s dinner party Twitter feed. It reminds me a little bit.
I'm not sure
what a paupiette is, even. Sounds like discussing earlier in terms of your dog.
Is it paupiette or paupiette? Anyway, she's put that in speech marks, I think, in inverted commas, paupiette, as if it's not quite sure what it is herself. Mm. And she ate it. So, there is a tiny subcategory of postcards from the 60s and 70s that enumerate or spell out whole menus of special meals.
So there's nothing new about people taking photographs of their lunch.
It's the equivalent of
the Instagram.
It's the early Instagram adopter. Plate. Goes back to, you know, as far back as you can trace. We'll probably find Egyptian hieroglyphs on stones of sort of, you know, owl, cat, plate of food, pyramid, all walking sideways.
Yes, what a delicious meal that was. Lunch, I love the owl and the cat especially.
Look at my lunch.
Yeah, no, well, I'm always intrigued by what... And it was special. So she wanted to tell Mr. and Mrs. Dean... Mrs. Dean and Miss... Barlow about it, and how interesting someone else's dinner is always debatable.
But Mrs. Dean and Miss Barlow shared an address, did they?
They did. I'm not going to tell you what the address is.
No, but that's just another little detail to think of, isn't it? What were Mrs. Dean and Miss Barlow? Perhaps one was the other's housekeeper. You
and I would
never
say
know.
These two cards, they are of exactly the same colour palette together.
Yeah.
They kind of merge into a dirty green.
Which is
English.
The Lake District all over, which I don't mean to insult your listeners from Cumbria. I love the Lake District.
But
I
those
know it quite well.
These are all purpose Technicolor English countryside postcards.
Yeah. I mean, luckily they've chucked some foxgloves, lupins, in the foreground of Wordsworth Cottage, which just gives it a bit more depth. Anyway, just to let you know at home, images of all the cards we discussed today are on the blog postcardfromthepast.co.uk, so you can tell that we're not making it up and you can discover for yourself. Now, Paul and David, you've been kind enough to come to the studio today with some postcards of your own. David, let's start with you. What's the first card you've got for us today?
Well, this is a card... Describe it. It's a sort of cityscape with a beautiful old building and a very tall tower on the right side. It's not immediately obvious that it's a minaret. It's not got precisely the spiky form that you might expect, but it is indeed a minaret. And it's actually the Great Mosque of Aleppo in Syria. So this is a postcard I was sent in about 2001, I think.
When it presumably still looked like that.
It did still look like that. I mean, and then that's the sad, devastating thing, is that minaret is no longer. And the minaret lasted from 1090 to 2013, when it was destroyed, presumably by a shell or something. But obviously there was fierce fighting in Aleppo, which has destroyed many of its monuments. So this was sent to me by a colleague of mine, a university colleague of mine. We studied Arabic together. We were sort of one of 11 or 12 oddball, eccentric types who decided it would be a good idea to study Arabic and Persian or various other languages, depending on what we'd opted for at university. And my friend was saying that, you know, I really must get... What does he say? It's well worth it. I think you would really enjoy Syria if you get the chance. And sadly, I never made it to Syria. And obviously, you know...
It would be a different country.
It's a different country now. And many of the monuments that he enjoyed and we would have enjoyed seeing are no more.
I have been to Aleppo and it was a beautiful city. And it had a sort of grandeur to it, actually. Particularly I do like going to markets, and the big souk was Aleppo was terrific.
Well, they're these huge mercantile centres. I mean, and also they have layer and layer, layer upon layer of history. You know, I think that the Great Mosque was the Agora originally.
Oh, okay.
You know, these things are adapted for different purposes as different civilizations roll in. But you know, the impression I get from similar cities. In the Middle East is that just these were these great crossroads. And I'm not sure whether Aleppo was on the Silk Route, but I'm sure it was a kind of entrepot of some kind and a trading nation and a sort of cosmopolitan, multicultural place before the modern version of that we're used to.
My son is learning Arabic.
Is he?
He's 22. He's just been... He was in Lebanon, and he very dutifully didn't go to Beirut because he knew it was very cosmopolitan and he wouldn't be forced to speak.
He went to
Tripoli in Lebanon, yes. Which is a place which not to be confused with Tripoli in Libya, obviously. But he's in very kind of does a lot of environmental work. He's just about to do an MA Imperial, but he's going to specialise in, or has been actually, in water scarcity and resort and sustainability the Middle East. So he's you know, brushing up his Arabic so he can do that.
Yeah.
Very good.
Good
so,
luck to
him. David, this card came from a friend, and have you kept in touch?
Haven't kept in touch. So I think, you know, this is about sort of 19, 20 years ago now. We haven't kept in touch, but most of your old university acquaintances, you're able to sort of, you know, search them out online and find them on Facebook or LinkedIn or whatever. The point about this guy is he's completely undiscoverable. There's no evidence of his name anywhere. He doesn't have a LinkedIn. He doesn't have Twitter or anything like that. And I suspect it's because he ended up going into the intelligence services, which is something that, you know, is an option for people who do unusual languages. Yeah. And I just have the feeling that's what happened to him.
Were you ever approached to join?
I wasn't approached.
How disappointing.
I wasn't. I know. It's a bit, you know, I wouldn't have done it. But
totally
untrustworthy. You want to be asked.
I'm sorry, David. You've now blown his cover. I'm going to have to kill both of you.
You won't be leaving this room.
Yes. Yes.
Well, perhaps your anonymous old colleague is even now sort of stalking the streets of Aleppo or similar cities. You never know.
Possible. Hopefully, I won't have identified him in some kind of, you know, in some kind of jigsaw way.
Naturally, we've changed the details. The card is in fact of Amsterdam.
David's name is actually Eric.
Yes, exactly. Well, it's very good. I think, I mean, I certainly for me, there's a kind of nostalgic feeling about that. And I can't remember when I was in Syria, but it was very, very memorable time. And you know, those holidays where you have to work hard, where you have to get the bus, and it's quite hard work, and it's a difficult language, and all that stuff. They stay with you in a way longer than those easy city breaks, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
Very good. So, Paul, we need to start with you. Now, the first card you want to discuss, you don't have any more.
I know.
Not quite sure how this works, but you're conjuring things up is what you
okay.
do. So.
When I moved about 3 years ago, somewhere in the move, I lost a file of mine, which was a box file, which was called the Weird File. And it was dated from the days before the internet. I mean, it's all redundant now, like half the information in my head. I used to delight in the fact that I was full of useless facts and information. Of course, now you can find nearly everything out in 5 seconds. But I used to have all cuttings and bits and pieces and odd art, just things that tickled me because they were weird. And this postcard, I believe, I put in that file, which I now can't find. It's driving me mad because I've been up in the attic twice and in the garage.
I've made you do that.
No, it was good exercise. But the postcard was sent to me in about 1980 by a girlfriend of mine who'd just gone to America for some reason. And it's I'm amazed that the postcard made it to England because it is essentially a postcard of a man and a woman standing, grinning at the camera, stark naked, full front noodle, as they say. And it was a sort of, I think it was a nudist colony promotional postcard, because the man's got a pipe in that rather odd way. And the woman's, they're just standing there, but it's all very, everything's out. It's all quite hairy.
But it's not flippant.
Bushy.
It's not for a joke.
No, it's just these two people completely naked. And it just astonishes me that this got through, because it wasn't in an envelope. It was a postcard of two naked, a man and a woman, stark naked. And it got through from America to the United Kingdom. As I say, this was...
I can see why you held on to it.
Yes, of course. It's very bereft that I can't find it. Hours of fun. But the other odd thing about this was that... because I just moved, I seem constantly moving, this girl, I was in my 20s or something, she didn't have my new address, so she sent this postcard to my parents' address. And my mother made no comment, she just handed it over, saying, oh, I can't remember her name, but that girl you went around with for a bit, she sent this from America and just handed it over. And it's a bit like, as I said, it's like watching TV. It doesn't matter whether you're 7 or 70. If you're watching TV with your mother or father or both and a sex scene comes on, it's never going to be... There's never a time that's going to be comfortable, unless you have a very peculiar family.
So it's never easy to receive a naked postcard via your mother.
Via your mother.
I think that's a life lesson.
Yeah, I think there's a lesson there for all of us somewhere, yeah.
But mercifully, in some ways, that card is not available
somewhere,
today.
Somewhere, but I don't know where it is.
You can go on the blog, you won't find it, so we won't be pulled down. But you do have another card with you which is real, and this is something you created?
Well, yes, I used to send these postcards. This is one that I kept, and I did a series of them in my... this is probably my very early 20s, or even,
People did do stuff like making things for messages. It's quite a creative thing to do, wasn't it?
People...
Expressive.
You're right, actually, because I can think of now of other people who did that. We used to send each other little things we'd made. And this is a postcard that is... It's a blank white postcard that says postcard on the back. And this is a postcard the address to be written on this side. Very helpful. But on the front, I've put a photo booth. I don't know if anybody remembers photo booth photos of me, which has been sort of doctored. I had a series of the, it's just me slightly out of focus looking into the photo booth camera, and I put red felt tip sort of flames all around it, and there's, for some reason, there's a big red cross over my mouth. Then overlaid on that is some cut-up stuff, because I was very keen. I just discovered Burroughs, William Burroughs, and... So there's a couple of found, overlaid, sort of rather artistic, well, I like to think it's artistic, over the photo of me is one snipped out bit of text from something or other that says, at that instant there came a more terrific crash than any that had preceded it, and the whole place glared with intense light, and when they recovered their senses, saw a sheet of flame coming from. So it's all slightly cut up. And then there's a bit across the bottom which says, fire, fire, she cried, your head is afire, it has been struck by lightning. And so I just sort of chopped these phrases up.
Well chosen, though, dramatic.
And there is a connection with the novel.
Yes, of course.
Dead Writers in Rehab, because I became a very keen, I think he's quite someone you usually discover when you're quite young, William Burroughs. And it was his partner, Brian Gysin, who's alleged to have discovered the cut-up technique, which then Burroughs adopted for... particularly for his novel The Naked Lunch. And people like, I think you mentioned earlier, David Bowie became very keen on it, all that sort of, as using it as a kind of doorway to the unconscious or the subconscious, the idea of a bit like the I Ching or Tarot, these phrases which may acquire some relevance because of their very apparent randomness. And I do in person. William Burroughs is one of the deceased substance abusers whose voice I impersonate, his literary voice I impersonate in the novel Dead Writers in Rehab. And just very briefly, I thought he would be one of the easiest ones, because you read William Burroughs, you read Naked Lunch, and you think, it's just chucking a bit of stuff about people turning into lizards and a couple of, you know, images of young of teenage boys sort of ejaculating as they're being hanged and typewriters melting and
the
Bob's
usual
your,
stuff.
Bob's your uncle. But of course, it turned out he was the most difficult one.
Really?
Because that stuff is meticulously crafted.
Yes, yes.
And was very, very, for about a year, it was edited by Brian Gysin and Allen Ginsberg. And you actually, you can parody it, but if you try to pastiche it, it gets very, very hard because yes. It's extremely well-crafted writing. So that was a kind of learning experience, if you like.
Yeah. It's funny, one of the things about your book, which is interesting, is that you've taken this, I'm not giving it away because the conceit is written on the cover, Dead Writers and Real, but you're not parodying the writers when you speak in their voices. You are... That bit is dead serious. You are trying to be there,
yes,
I think.
As I say, that to me, that's the difference between parody and pastiche. That may not be exactly the right but it's word, but it's interesting because parody, I kind of figured this out when I was doing a lot of satirical comedy, if you like, when I was writing a lot of comedy for radio and telly, that the thing about a parody is it can be very funny, but it's never going to be... It's always going to be lesser than what it's parodying.
It doesn't necessarily go very far, does it?
It's constrained by and has an inferior status to the original.
Yes, yes.
Whereas a kind of respectful mimicry, which I would call pastiche, is something that you might be able to be... But come up with something that is genuinely creative in its own right. I'm not suggesting for a moment that anything I've written in the voices of people like Coleridge or William Burroughs or Mary Seacole or any of those people is anyway goes beyond that. But it's an attempt to somehow it's life to me. It was a kind of like being possessed, channeling them.
Really,
and the way to do it was for me. It was like saying it wasn't about how can I get inside this writer's mind? Because that's absurd, because a writer doesn't write a book so that you can get inside their mind. No. What they're writing is they're trying to get inside your mind. So what you do is you have to open your mind and allow the writer to do what a writer does, which is to get inside your mind. There's no way I would ever get inside, Hunter Thompson's mind.
Yeah, yeah.
But he wrote in order to get inside a reader's mind. So it was making that reversal that was a kind of... if you like, a moment of realisation.
So the whole book is a cut-up, actually. It's a cut-up of different writers.
It is, in a way, yeah.
Very good. Well, I'm glad you brought that, because as we were saying, I think people used to send, particularly young people, like when you're young, silly, funny, odd, pretentious stuff to each other.
It's like writing poetry when you're a teenager.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. Did you do that in a very earnest way, do you think, or was it a bit of a joke? Was this kind of intense?
I think I thought I was being artistic,
right?
Although, like nearly everything I did, at whatever age, that it's never going to be without a humorous element to
it. Get out,
a mordant. Yeah, not so much that. Just that if your view of life is fundamentally that there's something both wonderful and funny about everything, then the answer is it was part of that kind of late teens, early 20s, like writing poems. No, but did you write poems when you were
no, I mean, I did at school.
You can be honest now, David.
I never did the kind of therapeutic or like, you know, I'm gonna write a poem about how angry I feel at my parents or whatever. No, I never did that. I mean, thank God.
Yeah, all that stuff survives now.
Well, that's the thing. You know, it's all out there. All of your progression through those awful phases is all documented and there permanently.
Yes, and I think if you'd had Twitter or Facebook or Instagram, maybe you would never have created those cards because you'd have found a different outlet.
I would have been able to. The idea that perhaps it would be seen, but in or more widely or something like that would have. I'd have been held back by potential embarrassment. So I think that's right. I wonder if that is constraining people's creative output.
Well, I don't know, because there are... It's possible to be very creative with sort of... I don't know. And now I'm going to show my age, but, you know, I'm going to use the wrong examples, but with GIFs or whatever, or on Snapchat or whatever. And some of these things are deliberately ephemeral, like Snapchat or Instagram stories. But you get people doing the most the cleverest things with bits of text and so on, and kind of like fuzzy highlighted bits. And
and with so much meaning packed into something apparently simple.
And reference to other things. So you can get lost in a kind of hall of mirrors of, oh, that's referring to that meme, and it's a kind of...
I think you're right. It's just convoluted the creative. It's just put it into a different set of contexts. And I think
maybe.
But what's
it's
nice,
never going to die, is
what's
it?
Nice about what you brought along is the physicality, because that's what the digital world doesn't have. And obviously, I like that with postcards. Is that the sense of these are real physical things, and that in itself has a whole set other meaning to it. Now, talking of postcards, which is kind of what we're here for. Because of your interest in language, David, I would normally do another of these funny cards here, but I thought I'd do something different. Postcards at the beginning of the century, beginning of the 20th century, there was a sort of meme, if you like, a theme or a meme, the language of. And they were very keen on expressing or codifying or giving people sort of idiot's guides to various languages.
Oh, fantastic.
So a couple of cards here, the language of flowers. Now, I think you hear about Victorians understanding the language of flowers, but they elaborate it here, I think, beyond all good sense, but I don't know.
Yeah, so the language of flowers. So these are messages that you're conveying with flowers. So, for example, the red rose means I am dying with love, which is...
Not just love, dying with love.
Dying with love, which is kind of, you know, the roses in love is not a leap.
You've got a different one from...
Yes, you've got different ones.
Okay.
The narcissus apparently means when can I see you again, which is actually quite, it's
like
quite specific.
Yeah.
Oh, I see, of course.
Narcissus should be when can I see myself again.
But guess what forget-me-not means? This is a tricky
one. Forget-me-not? I don't know, David.
Do not forget me, according to the card. Oh, a nettle. A nettle means I have no liking for you.
Okay, this makes good sense. I buy this.
So some of them are easier to pass than others, I think. A rhododendron is be cautious.
Okay.
Oh,
what do you got, Paul?
I thought you were going to say forget me not. It means I think I've got dementia. Well, I've got mine are just...
Don't worry, we'll edit that out.
You see, yours have got messages.
Maybe they're not quite uniform.
Poppy, I am not free. Yeah, you see, mine are
Poppy
just...
would be different now, post-First World War. Poppy would be about remembrance.
Yeah, but that's interesting. It says, I am not... See, so that's the way I'm sending a signal or a message to someone.
Supposedly.
Mine are just sort of these, on this card, these are just idea, one-word things. For example, Jasmine, faithfulness.
Okay.
Cornflower, riches. I'm very intrigued to see that Edelweiss is cleanliness.
Really?
So if you sent an Edelweiss to somebody...
Maybe that's the Swiss.
It might be a hint.
Yeah. I like you. You're clean.
Or it might be a bit of a hint.
Scrub up, mate.
Sort of, it's like sort of B.O. It's like sending someone some deodorant or something. Convolvulus is tender love. And violet, of course, is modesty.
Very good. You see, I think this is legit. I think these flowers, these meanings are well known. I think they're correct. However,
this was sent to a Miss Bull. This one.
The fashion for this kind of thing.
I love this.
Then got a bit out of hand. There were loads of these languages of. Here's a pair. Now this is the language of eyes.
Oh my God.
Now you have no choice over what your eyes
are.
That's
true. So it's a bit more like a star sign or something, isn't it?
Yes.
Because you can't really change it.
Are yours in French, David?
No, they're not.
Okay, but mine are. Go on.
So there's six eyes swimming around, disembodied.
They're kind of surreal as well, just being
there. Slightly surreal.
Single
as well.
Eyes.
Some of them are left eyes, some of them are right eyes. grey eyes represent, apparently, according to this postcard, cunning.
Oh.
Which feels potentially a bit unfair on people with grey eyes.
Not to the French, because on this one it says "Yeux gris," which is grey. Is it grey?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Volonté, énergie.
Willfulness and energy, is that?
I should know, being the language person.
What
I don't know what volonté means.
So your eyes change meaning as you cross the channel, I imagine.
Well, that's sure interesting. So you could, if you were a cunning grey-eyed person, you could go over and have a different life.
Frankly, I'd better go to France.
Remake yourself.
Remake yourself as someone volonté and energy. When you came back, you were just some sly, cunning dog.
Are there any good... What's the good colour to have?
Chestnut brown is amiable.
Okay, like a dog.
And brown is constant. So there's a bias towards brown eyes. Actually, blue eyes, blue means faithful.
Yes, I think that's a sort of traditional idea.
Green is changeful.
Oh, green, yes, distrustful.
So, I've got one with a shape here, which is yurond, so round eyes, and of course that's credulité.
Ah, oh, yeah, because you believe anything, right?
Yeah, wide-eyed. Wide-eyed
and legless. What do you think Havan? Well, that looks like brown, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But that in France is longueur and sentimentalité.
Oh, I see.
They obviously completely changed it all.
So I think really we think it's a load of old rubbish. Is that what we're thinking?
No, I think it's great. I think it's a bit like, you go further back, like they used to have a language of fans, didn't they? Regency times, a woman could signal.
Well, there's the handkerchief language of San Francisco gay men.
Yes,
yeah, and how you used your fan.
But presumably, as you debunk various language myths in your book, simple understandings of these languages are probably always wrong. Because languages, by definition, are complex.
Languages are complex. I think with the flowers that we saw earlier, I think that's kind of signalling. It's almost kind of semaphore, isn't it? So it's a very basic code. But quite useful.
Code, not a language.
Well, do you know what? It reminds me of, because there is certain groups that have been unable to express themselves properly, and gay men is an example of that, you know, developed famously Polari, which was an argo or a slang, or a kind of auxiliary language, which enabled them to communicate things which would have been taboo. So these are a little bit like that, or certainly the flowers. There's a very basic way of getting something across. So, you know, saying, I am not free. Or whatever it is a way of doing a covert communication.
Yes, but a complicated way to live your life. And the eye one, you have no choice.
Exactly.
You can wink your eye, but you can't.
Well, is there a modern equivalent, do you think, of this, of a kind of... an undercurrent... I mean, there's the obvious one of kids, you finding ways, you know, Netflix and chill, but I'm just wondering... If there is, in terms of what you just said about people wanting to express things which were sort of taboo or repressed.
Yeah, I think there will always be sort of argos and ways of getting something across, because there are always going to be situations where you don't want everyone to know what you're talking about. And, you know, kids is a good example on chat forums or people talking about drugs or whatever it may be, and they don't want to sort of leave an obvious trace of that. I think that kind of thing is always going to go on.
Yeah, and there's those on sort of right wing, you know, alt-right forums, they have these codes about saying all these horrible things without actually expressing them fully.
Yes, and I think one of them was sort of three brackets either side of someone's name was a way of indicating that they were Jewish.
Yes.
And then, of course, Jewish people and non-Jewish people who wanted to sort of rail against this started adopting those, reclaiming them, as it were, as a proud thing.
That's in the fast-moving digital communication world, where these things come and they go very fast.
Huge turnover, I think.
Well, this I think may be the apotheosis of these silly postcard languages. This one here.
The language of umbrellas. Okay.
It's not an obvious one, is it? It's not an obvious one.
This is about where you put your umbrella, the kind of stance that you take. There's a lady.
You are a nice boy.
Right.
But she's just holding an umbrella more or less normally. But I think she's pointing at the ground.
Well, is it that she's using her right hand and she's going across her leg so it ends up on the other side of her left?
I can't quite see. Oh, yes, she is. She's crossing her lower body.
Try this at home.
With a long, thin object.
There's a slightly sort of poignant one, which is, I'm longing to be loved. Where she's sort of cradling the umbrella
like a baby.
This is actually what you're saying. This is the secret code of behaviour.
Look at that one. She's being very bold. She's standing with... Wasn't that the pose?
That's the Tory
power stance, but with an umbrella thrust down the middle.
That makes sense. No one knows why else they did that.
I would say that's a pretty brazen hussy doing that. Will you come with me, she's saying.
The problem with this is that the range of this language, the number of initiates would be so small that you could be standing in Russell Square with an umbrella doing it every which way and no one would get what you were saying, alas. You wanted to go away with someone.
There may have been a vast...
But this is a subject you don't really talk about in your book, but which is inventing languages. Because if you're the first person to invent a language, it isn't a language. It's a series of codes, a series of signs that have no meaning. You need a recipient to be able to communicate with. So if this had taken off, this could have been, you know, this could have been the internet. Umbrellas.
Umbrellas. The language of umbrellas. Well,
I'll close our conversation about the language of umbrellas with a card that actually makes fun of the language of umbrellas, who I think realise this is a load of old tosh. So here's a sort of jokey cartoon.
So it's headlined The Language of Umbrellas still, but it's two guys, and the caption is, "To return an umbrella means, well, never mind what it means, nobody ever does it."
Which I think is quite good. We all know hats and umbrellas get lost. That's gloves.
There's that shop down the road in Russell Square, isn't there, where the lost property used to be, where they had thousands of umbrellas that were all lost property.
Umbrellas are there to be lost.
Yeah. They never last very long, do they?
But, of course, you know, there's a sense in which these never were meant to be real codes, never meant to be real languages. They were a fun thing to send through the post. And in a way, they're a little bit like the things people like to talk about language aren't necessarily true, but they're pleasant and fun to talk about. They appeal to people.
So. I like to think there's a bunch of umbrellas in that shop all communicating in a language that they've made up about us.
Maybe they are. But it's nice to think that there may be these secret codes around the place, and that's, you know, one of the things I talk about in my book is the romance of that idea of there being this undiscovered meaning, which, if only you had the key, would be revealed to you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think if you're to look at this in a slightly historic context, these are basically between 1900 and 1914, when postcards were booming. I mean, there were millions and millions of cards sent every week. And so there was a real explosion of communication. There was more education and literacy amongst the working classes. People were working away from their family home. So suddenly this sort of mass communication was really important and really busy. So the idea that people will play with other kinds of ideas and languages seems perfectly natural to me. It seems like a sort of a playful kind of reflection on the communication explosion that was going on.
There's a lot of my father died, I found a lot of postcards that he had that were sent by his father in the First World War. And that's a whole genre of, because there was, as you say, the explosion of communication. And they, particularly from France, the soldiers sent back these very kind of, it's very poignant. Mm. I didn't bring any of them because I just felt they belong with the people who sent them and received them, I think.
Yeah, no, there is definitely that. And would they have been through the censor? Would they have had a censor stamp on them?
It didn't. I've seen some which didn't seem to have been censored, but I think there was more of that in the Second World War. I don't think that. I think the censorship, because everybody knew where all the British army was, they were sat in a trench in the middle of France, not moving more than 5 yards at a time. So I don't know that it was...
They introduced these cards where you had to just tick a box.
Yeah, that's right.
Which I suppose were the predecessor of the jocular cards, where you tick a box, same having a nice time on the beach. Yeah. But these were saying, I am safe, I'm at the front, I'm well, or I'm injured, but I'm alive.
I might be wrong about that censorship. I just recall one particularly, which was a sort of classic saucy French postcard, but very, very harmless, really. But obviously the troops liked to send it back because it was a sort of ooh-la-la and a mamselle. And
cheerful, I suppose, in times that weren't cheerful.
You wanted to reassure your family that it wasn't as grim as it was.
Well, the thing about those First World War cards very often also is that they can't say very much explicitly, but they underline the fact that it's the sending of the card that says everything, actually.
Yes, they all say things like, just dropping a line to let you know all is well.
Yes, I'm in the pink.
Yeah, that's right. I'm in the pink. And things like that. Fantastic.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You're listening to Podcasts from the Past, the Postcard Podcast, and my guests today are Paul B. Davis and David Shariat-Madari. Now, David, under a pile of strange languages, we've got some more cards from you. So what's the second lump of cards you've got for us?
Well, I've got this little card, which is... perhaps you can... Can you have a guess at what that is?
It's a reptile of some sort.
It is a reptile.
But it's sort of jewelled in some way. It's like a lizard with lapis lazuli or emeralds.
Yeah. So what is it? It's
the card kind of, almost glistens, actually.
It does,
it's
actually.
On a black
I think
bed,
they've done
it?
That on purpose. To sort of. So it's a piece of jewellery from the Cheapside Hoard, which is a hoard of jewels that was discovered in a very sort of fairy tale way. Under some floorboards in Cheapside in London in the in 1912. And it's now with the Museum of London, and it's going to be sort of showcased in their new building, which they're developing in Smithfield. But I went to see the Cheapside Hoard, I think for the first time collected together in decades, to write about it for the New Statesman. And it was very sort of beguiling. It was just a beautiful... I think the thing about these jewels is that they're all quite rough-hewn. They're okay. Not sort of, you know, Swarovski, sort of shiny, sparkly. They're all quite sort of... They have that early modern Elizabethan sort of chunkiness to them.
When does it date from, that one?
So I think they're all mainly from the 16th and 17th century. So this is a salamander with emeralds on its back. And I don't know whether a salamander is a reptile or an amphibian or whether there's a difference. And so I'm sure you will get people writing about that.
Well, it's as much a mythical creature as a real creature, isn't it, a salamander?
Well, the aspect of it that's mythical is, again, sort of related to this thing we were talking about special codes and communication, because a lot of these jewels had a particular significance. So, for example, there was a little parrot... and the parrot was a symbol of erotic love because parrots are supposed to be promiscuous. Mm-hmm. That was a sort of trope
that
everyone knew in those days, but it's lost on us now. And the salamander is supposed to represent resurrection because salamanders are reputed to be able to walk through fire and survive. So that was another message. It sort of evoked that aspect of religious faith, really.
How big is this? I mean, the postcard is postcard size, but how big is the jewel?
I think it's a brooch, and I don't think it's huge. I think it's probably a few centimetres long.
Because it looks kind of enormous, though.
It does look
detail.
Enormous, yeah. And I think it's got sort of pearly legs. They're probably mother of pearl or something. Mm. And just these smooth, rounded emeralds rather than sort of faceted, cut emeralds.
So what was the... So you said... Sorry, you said the significance was that the sort of message, code was...
So the code was that this stood for resurrection.
Right.
So it was quite a pious thing to wear, unlike the parrot.
So if you saw were we talking 15th century, did you say? If you saw a cardinal wearing a salamander, that would make perfect sense. But if you went to, say, or went to the priest and he was wearing a parrot, you think, hello, this is... What's the origin of the parrot thing? How far
I don't
back
know.
Does that
go? I don't know. But what surprised me at the time is that this is something, and there were another one or two things that I can't remember now. I think there was another animal that signified piety or something. And you know, these were obviously just characteristics that everyone sort of knew about.
Yes.
I can't think of an equivalent today, but.
I sometimes think. I remember at school, many years ago, we were reading Shakespeare. Or being taught to read Shakespeare. Yeah. And the teacher would explain all the multiple layers of meaning and nuances. And we go, this can't be right. Surely the people didn't understand all that stuff because words are words are words. How do they have all these layers of meaning in it? And they said, well, in those days, the teacher said, people were hypersensitive, acutely aware of language and nuance. They didn't have television. So their brain power of the theatre goer was all wrapped up in the nuances and the meanings of words. And that kind of sat with me. And I don't know if I believed it, but it sat with me. But now you go onto the internet, or social media in particular, and there's a sort of hyper-awareness people have of the tiniest nuances of language at which people will rightly or wrongly take massive offence or be particularly amused or pick up and redouble and point out to other people as being outrageous or wonderful. I wonder if we've entered now a sort of second age of linguistic hypersensitivity. Discuss.
There has long been a sort of people on Twitter say petitioning for a sarcasm button. So just to sort of say, not just LOL, but just something where they can make quite an elaborate statement, but try to make it clear that they're being ironic or sarcastic or something like that.
But as a writer, you know, if you need a button to say it, you're not doing your job
right. You're not doing it right.
That's exactly what I mean, would say, Tom.
I tend to think things haven't changed as much. I think the reason that, codes in Shakespeare or allusions in Shakespeare that we might have to be taught, we might have to be taught them now... But that's not an indication that they were sort of hidden at the time. I think it's just an indication that everyone at that time was tapped into all of these other things. Like, you know, there was enormous knowledge of the Bible, for example, and other texts that would have just been obvious and self-evident.
So in other words,
and they're
guess
hidden
what?
To us.
They knew the context of their time because they were living in it.
Exactly, exactly. And with the internet, you know, I mean, it's like what I was saying about... memes that reference other memes. And actually, if you're outside of that, the group within which those things are known, then it's going to be alienating. It's going to be like they're speaking in code. But actually, it's a web of reference, of cultural and social reference that you're not necessarily privy to.
So it's not so much that it's actually just being immersed in that world to understand things.
And maybe there are more sort of... I mean, the internet presents great opportunity for subculture, doesn't it? For the fostering of subcultures. And the weird thing is that we're able to access them and look at them and observe them, but we might not necessarily be part of them. So you can have that slightly disorienting experience of looking at this thing and going, what on earth are they talking about?
Oh,
what's
yes.
that reference to?
And, if you find yourself, if you follow enough, you know, you find yourself on Black Rap Twitter or Sikh Twitter or certain, you know, particular Southeast Asian Twitter, it is very much, you suddenly realise that the little party you've been in is not Twitter.
It's not the whole world.
It's not the whole world by any means.
And there's a web of reference there.
And that's why I like to follow those connections and end up in odd places. It does, as you say.
It's enriching.
Reminds you that, to keep your mind open rather than... Because it's very easy to... Because that's what those platforms really want us to do, is narrow down. It's like Amazon saying, you've bought this book, you probably like this one. It's like, no, thank you. I want to go to a bookshop and look at something.
Your echo chamber has windows.
Yeah, let's try and get out of it every now and again,
Now, well, that's very good. I like what the salamander has done. But that's not the only strange animal you've got with you.
I've got another animal. So this is, in postcard terms, it's a bit more conventional because the salamander I picked up at the exhibition and bought it for myself. This next one is one that my mum sent me from holiday in New Zealand.
So and genuine family a postcard in the
genuine
traditional
family,
sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is a... And I haven't looked up how to pronounce this, but I'm saying it like this. It's a takahe, which is a slightly dumpy... flightless bird with a very powerful beak, and it's just walking across a sort of bit of grass.
Great colour.
Beautiful, sort of emerald green, kind of peacock blue, and a sort of yellow, well, not yellow orange, it's kind of more orange red beak.
It's like a kiwi in drag or something, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a kind of fancy kiwi, a kiwi on prom night or something. And the reason my mum picked this out for me is because she knows that I like... New Zealand birds, in particular one, the kakapo, which is a parrot that's been made famous by Stephen Fry in his TV series Last Chance to See. Now, Last Chance to See was based on a Douglas Adams radio series in 1989, which became a book. Douglas Adams and Mark Carwardine
in 1990, and which I think I bought for my brother as a Christmas present or a birthday present, but then basically never gave it to him. Or gave it to him, but basically claimed it for myself and became obsessed with this book. And the conceit of this book was visiting all of these animals which are on the brink before they disappear forever, hence Last Chance to See.
It's a big idea, isn't it?
It's a big idea, and it's extraordinary. It's really exciting. But for us, you know, I was 10 or 11, really captured the imagination, because it's about adventuring, it's about seeing these extraordinary creatures. You know, there's a bottlenose dolphin, or the Yangtze dolphin, I think. There's the Komodo dragon. And then there's this parrot, the kakapo, which I think is a sort of mascot for slightly awkward misfits, because it's a huge parrot. It's quite rubbish at reproducing and actually even doing anything. It can't fly. It's very prone to... It's very friendly. See, it's very trusting and friendly, and therefore just gets kebabbed by any human that encounters it. So Mum says, I haven't found a picture of a kakapo, but actually I think a takahe is more interesting to look at and more dignified, but probably can't boom, because kakapos boom. That's how
she knows you well.
She knows me too well. But there is... So can I just sort of evangelise for New Zealand birds? Because they are fascinating. So New Zealand didn't have any land mammals. Yeah. So all of the birds... Well, basically all of the ecological niches that are normally occupied by mammals in the rest of the world, whether that's sort of you're a grazing antelope or you're a predating lion, are occupied by birds in New Zealand. And the birds evolved into these extraordinary shapes and to do these extraordinary things, because they were in those niches. So there's a giant extinct bird called the moa, which is huge and looks like a huge kind of bottom-heavy ostrich. And that fulfilled the ecological niche of the antelope or the deer.
Right.
Because it was a grazing animal. There's a huge another extinct eagle called Haast's eagle, which was the apex predator, so that fulfilled the ecological niche of the lion or whatever. I've been trying to figure out what the takahe might be a stand-in for. So it basically grazes on alpine meadows and alpine grasses. I think it's kind of mountain goat.
Yeah.
It's a goat that thinks it's a bird.
Yeah, exactly. And I just think it's just fascinating. It's like a crazy evolutionary laboratory by virtue of it being an island was sort of untouched by mammals, apart from a couple of bats.
Have you been to New Zealand to look at these things?
I haven't, and that's something I must do.
I think that sounds like itch will be scratched.
Yeah, exactly.
I have been to New Zealand, but I didn't see anything that looked like
This is the devastating thing, is there are only 347 of these takahes.
No wonder I missed them.
Yeah, you didn't look hard enough.
there are only 142 kakapos.
But if I was one of those 300 and whatever, I'd be hiding.
Yeah. and although they're brightly coloured, they are green. They've got somewhere to hide, I think.
Yeah, that's true.
It's amazing.
Very good. Very good. Well, it's intriguing. It's an insight, not just into your family relationship, but into your mother's knowledge of your obsessions. Yeah. I think that's the
end. Too well.
Mother always knows you best. Very
sorry
good.
I didn't get you the Xbox for Christmas, but I think you'll find these socks a lot more interesting, actually.
Yeah, that's a well-known rhythm, isn't it, from mother to child. So, Paul, you're staying with strange creatures, for your last couple of cards.
It's got me thinking about, the use we make of animals and creatures. I mean, the last couple I've got was like this one I had on my fridge for a long time.
A great place to keep cards.
Yeah, and it's just profoundly disturbing. but it's just fluffy animals. However,
they can be very sinister.
Yeah. There's no caption or anything. There's no explanation given. There's no context. But essentially, there's a teddy bear tied to a chair leg. It's all in actual size. So it's a teddy bear tied to a chair leg as though about to be sacrificed or burned or possibly martyred in the manner of Saint Sebastian with bows and arrows. And surrounding it, or watching it rather impassively, is a collection of other stuffed animals, including a Bambi, a rabbit, a fluffy monkey with his hands up, a lion, what do you think that is? I have no idea. Is that a dog?
Is it a monk? Oh, it's a dog. I think
sitting
it's a dog.
On its bottom.
And yeah. This is not a photo montage. This is a real diorama that's been set up.
Someone has gone to the trouble of setting up this scene and taking a photograph of it. It's no indication of what it is. Oh, it's German, which probably doesn't surprise me that much. It's called Cowboys and Indians.
So, we're thinking perhaps this was set up specifically for the photograph. It's not a postcard from a strange museum.
No.
It's an image that was created. Someone said, we've got to sell some postcards. I know.
Yes.
We'll get those cuddly toys and put them into a disgusting and terrifying...
Yes, it is quite... unless this is just a snapshot of someone who happens to have this tableau set up in his or her house.
That'll do.
Yes, they go, oh, look, I'll take a snap of that. Those animals I've always had posed in the corner enacting a horrible and bizarre sacrifice.
It's quite sort of a fluffy toy Wicker Man, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, very much so.
And, of course, those dead glass eyes are... They can mean what you want them to mean.
Yeah. You know, it's just, I don't know why, I don't know where it came from or why I had it, but I just liked it.
Well, cars are irresistible.
Mm. And the last bit is just a classic sort of...
This may be slightly less authentic in its in its sort of photographic verisimilitude.
Yes, I think the photographer would have had to have been very, very keen to have snapped this, because it's actually a photograph of a kangaroo on a surfboard, and it says, oh, boy... How do I stop this bloody thing? So it's a comedy. It's a jokey card, which a girl sent me from when she went to Australia in 1985. And it's just...
85?
Yeah.
You've held on to that a long time.
I just found it in one of the files I did find, which is old postcards, it said, but none of
Brilliant.
Them... But this other one wasn't in there. And it's just a classic example of... It did get me thinking when you were talking about these animals, and we kind of fetish... The slightly fetishistic approach to saying, I know what would be amusing, a dog on a skateboard. And then someone else, I know what would be even more amusing is two dogs on a skateboard and one of them smoking a pipe.
Yeah.
And then you just think, oh, and you'd click on that if it was a...
Probably.
You'd say, yeah, that's amusing to see. But, you know... Kangaroo on a surfboard, dog on a skateboard, cat at a typewriter. It's this weird...
What was it, the PG Tips, the chimpanzee?
Oh, yeah,
yes.
Yeah,
now,
yeah.
Now, that was
but
a strange...
all now banned because...
Of course.
Yeah.
Because they turned out they didn't like the tea. No, it was... I don't know, they don't... Yes, they used to... But not only was it in the advert, you used to be able to go to the zoo and attend.
Oh,
they would every Wednesday...
Chimp's tea party.
The chimp's tea party.
Yes.
And the chimps and the kids would sit...
Sponsored by PG? Or just...
Nope,
no.
This was...
If only I'd known we were going to discuss this. I have a collection of postcards of chimp's tea parties.
Do you?
We'll do it for the next series. We'll do that.
Oh, God, yes. Oh, no, that sounds extraordinary. But, yeah, it's the anthropomorphism, obviously, but there's something else, I think. There's that thing of the juxtaposition of particularly that kind of, dog on a skateboard type of...
It distracts you so...
It's the ideal distraction.
Yeah.
If you're working, I would rather just look at a picture of a dog, or a little video of a dog on a skateboard for 30 seconds, and that's the ideal break.
And it's sort of universal. We all want to... I mean, we may not feel good about it, but we all want to look at that.
Or the cat falling over, the cat failing to jump from one shelf to the other. It's just... There's something perfect. It just completely bypasses whatever you're meant to be thinking about. And the label you just to look at something, laugh, and then forget it forever.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's the opposite of David's kind of very interesting overview of the way animals have evolved in New Zealand. This is animals. They're funny.
Yeah, exactly. That's all
but
we need to know.
Conforming to national stereotype as well, because I suppose if we thought about what a kangaroo would be like, they'd probably be a kind of laid-back beach guy.
Yeah.
Like we think Australians
are. Don't you remember Skippy the
kangaroo? I know, but I didn't watch Skippy.
Skippy. He was one of those kind of, what's that, Skippy? Tommy's fallen down the well.
Yeah, that's
one
right,
of those ones. Yeah, you're right.
But also, it's yoking together stereotypes.
Yeah.
Surfing, kangaroo. What can we do? Let me think. How are we going to make this work? I know.
And then there was whichever weirdo first had the idea that that it would be a great spectacle to box, to fight a kangaroo.
Oh.
Because
there's footage of that, isn't there? Post-war.
But they do
pre-war.
Sort of box, don't they?
Yeah.
Kangaroos box each other.
It's like
so
hares
who
do a mating thing. Because I've got a fantastic little clip of when I was up in, last time I was in Norfolk, of two hares giving it the boxing.
Right.
And then a third one runs in to the arena, as it were, which is a cornfield. And then they all chase each other around in a circle for about a minute. but it's a mad march. I think that's where the Mad March hair things come from. They do get very over hormonal.
Right.
They get very juiced up on whatever it is that makes hairs randy, and they go a bit crazy.
Typical, so that's typical bloody hairs.
Yeah, that's obviously where that comes from.
Well, my head is spinning from these cars today, actually. But thank you both so much for bringing them in. I'm thrilled that you shared them with each other, with me, with the listeners. Another quick reminder for everyone at home, you can see images of these cards, and you'll need to see them to believe them, on the blog postcardfromthepast.co.uk, including a last one from me in the past postcard style, which you may have seen on Twitter or the book, an old card from which I'm taking just a bit of a message. And this is a multi-view, as they call it, with the four images of Budley Salterton. And this was from 1970, first class mail, someone's written on it, an old fivepenny stamp. And the bit that intrigued me, it's a message about an upcoming journey or holiday. It says, after much more chat, M and Aunt are not going to travel with us, but catch an afternoon train to London. Much better. So can now feel sick on my own.
Yeah.
So
it's not like the best holiday, does it?
No.
It didn't end well, did it? M and Aunt took the train back to London.
Yeah, and then they were sick. But anyway, before I let Paul and David back into the blazing London sunshine, I've got one more postcard for you both. Which it has become customary for us to end the programme with one of these. So that's one for you to have a look at.
Is this for us to identify?
If you want to.
It looks like the Lake District again.
Possibly Scotland.
I feel like I sort of know the silhouettes of those mountains, but maybe I'm imagining it.
You're welcome to turn it over and
oh, okay.
It's not a competition. There are no prizes.
Oh, it's Loch Lomond. You were right.
That's because I've driven past there a few times.
And it's a hi-fi musical view card. How does that work?
Oh, it's got a...
It's got grooves.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So you'd put that on your turntable.
And then...
How extraordinary. Have you tried to play it?
Well, young Tom in the next room has been paying some attention to us, and if we ask him nicely, he might be able to turn the old technology into something newer. Something coming up?
A bit scratchy. Oh.
I think she's... Is that the Bonnie Branks of Loch Lomond? So
yep.
They are singing about the picture?
Yep.
There is no dissonance between one side and the other this time. Oh, that's rather sad tune. Oh.
I mean, the fidelity is not bad, given that it's a piece of paper, a square piece of paper that's being played.
I say the same thing every time. It's not bad for a piece of cardboard. It's pretty amazing. And I don't think it's been through the post, this one, though. There was no stamp on it, but... Oh. There are a few scratches. But then I've got records at home with scratches, and they're on vinyl, so...
It's a very sentimental version of this, which is a sentimental song to start with, let's face it.
Oh, there's more. Oh. Sorry, it's not over yet.
Oh, right.
It's a bit of a sort of Glee Club version, as it sounds a bit American, the style of singing. Well, as the banks of Loch Lomond continue to spin at 45 RPM.
Fade into the gloaming.
That's it for this time on Podcast from the Past. I'd very much like to thank my first-class guests for sharing the postcards from their pasts. David Shariat-Madari and Paul B. Davis. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. Bye for now. You can see more postcards with their messages posted every day on Twitter. Do follow me, at @PastPostcard. And you can buy the book, Postcard from the Past, by me, Tom Jackson, at Amazon and all good booksellers. And if you're looking for podcast production, check out wardorstudios.co.uk.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.